What do we do? How do we get up off the floor of Trumpism? Because I think we saw this experiment with Biden of being like, the witch is dead, you know, like we're free again. And it was a fucking catastrophe.
Yeah.
Like right away.
Hi, I'm Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And welcome to The Argument. This is a show where two friends argue about politics, policy, and whatever else we're interested in that week. This week, Matt has a take.
I do. I think that asylum is not really something that we can or should bring back from Donald Trump and the Trump era.
It's a depressing take, Matt. Depressing take. Why?
Because, I mean, I think that the concept of a legal right to asylum as it was enshrined in the post-World War II era worked well enough for a long time, but it was very small. You know, like very few people were actually taking advantage of the right to asylum. And then over time, you know, to put a little bit of a slightly arbitrary number on it, but like starting in 2014 in the United States and then propelling forward, it became more and more of a loophole, essentially, right? A thing where people had learned, immigration lawyers in the United States, people smugglers, would-be immigrants, that this was like a way to gain entry.
Well, let's just start from first principles here. Like, what is the point of asylum?
The purpose of asylum is to help people in need. The functioning of asylum.
But specifically, political asylum was created for people who had a well-founded fear of persecution. And this was largely in the context of like political persecution from the state. So like whether it's people fleeing communism or the idea you'd be fleeing the fact that you were going to be genocided by your own government. Like that's the idea of political asylum, not just like helping random people around the world.
Sure, yes. Yeah. But I mean, but I also I want to draw a distinction because there's the concept of a refugee. Right. Which is like, this is a person who we are going to allow to come live in our country because, you know, they're facing some kind of problems in their homeland and we're helping them out. It's humanitarian immigration. But refugee resettlement, you know, exists in a like numerical framework. Right. Like a country says we are willing to resettle X number of refugees and, you know, we do it. And that's like many different things that governments do to try to be helpful actors in the world. The idea of asylum, right, is that it's a procedural legal right, you know, that like you can just, you know, there's an immigration officer and they're like, you're not here legally. We're going to deport you now. But then you can say, no, like I need asylum here, right? And it's supposed to be like with any kind of like judicial legal process, right, just judged on the basis of the facts. Right. It's not a discretionary government decision how many people are going to get asylum. It's if the asylum claims are valid on the facts and the law, you get it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what started to happen is that when very few people are making asylum claims, the asylum claims are adjudicated very expeditiously, and maybe not that many people are being granted asylum. And it just goes on and on for years and years and years as like a low-level aspect of the American immigration system. But when I graduated college in 2003, I covered the 2007 immigration reform debate. I covered the 2013 immigration reform debate. I covered a lot of arguments that were happening between then and now. We were talking almost exclusively during those periods, we were talking about what to do with the stock of illegal immigrants living in the country and what should we do about, you know, ongoing flows of illegal immigrants. And then we started to talk about legal immigration, like visa allocation. But shortly after the 2013 compromise fell apart, we started getting more and more debate about asylum claims. First, it's because people were sending sort of teenagers alone to come to the United States because there were legal restrictions on the government's ability to, you know, incarcerate children, essentially, right? So if you came and you were caught and you made an asylum claim, then while that was being processed through the system, you could be released to like a relative or a family friend or something like that. Which again, if you're thinking about like one unaccompanied minor who shows up at the southern border, that totally seems like the correct way to handle the situation, right? It's like, that's what I would do. I think it's what anybody would do. But it became a flood of people because it became clear that...
I mean, it wasn't that many people. in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about in the tens of thousands. We're not talking about anywhere near.
But it was too many people for the system to handle.
Sure.
Right? Because the system was built on the presumption.
But I think this is actually a really good place. Because like the fact that there are many people who are in bad situations that would not qualify as political asylees, right? They're not like, my government is not trying to genocide me. They're not trying to like destroy me, but are in a bad situation that anyone would be like, yeah, it doesn't seem good. Like maybe you're in a domestic violence situation. Maybe you're in a situation where like, you know, there's a bunch of crime in your country and that's really unsafe and it's bad. But you're not specifically being targeted, or you're just like really, really poor and you're looking for a better job. Like people can understand that that's not a good thing and you might want to go search for a better life here. And they notice that the asylum system might be a place for them to like say like, okay, well, I am following, you know, maybe this, there's a smuggler or there's some sort of like, you know, there's an informal economy that's been set up to like help me get into the United States. And they tell me to go to an, across the U.S. southern border, go up to an American official and say, hey, I'm here for asylum. And then someone will help me figure it out. And in the meantime, I'll probably be able to get a work permit and be able to stay here for a few years. And the fact that that happens, I think, is like, not really contested at this point. What I think is strange is the turn from there's clearly a problem here to the whole system doesn't work. Because to me, like the number, like the amount of money it would take to actually make it possible to run the backlog through is like not, it's like negligible. It's like a drop in the pond of the US federal budget. So the Lankford Murphy Sinema Border Act, they thought they could get that down to like processing those claims under 90 days in that case. I think that's a little optimistic. And like the Manhattan Institute, not a liberal outlet, themselves also had very similar estimates, about $1 billion a year. It would take a little bit longer when there's a backlog built up because you can't just like hire thousands of officers. But like, I don't get how you go from there's a problem with the system to like just throw it out.
Well, I mean, I think the question is like, what are we trying to do with our $1 billion? Because say it's not $1 billion, say it's $3 billion. Right? Same difference. Like it's not that much money.
Yeah.
Right? Like $3 billion on addressing a significant problem is like money well spent. But the question
is, we spend like $11 billion on ICE right now.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not like we're not spending money on immigration.
So the question is like, what is the problem? Like what are we trying to do? Right. And what I remember all during Trump's first term, you know, I was doing the weeds then. We had a number of immigration episodes over the years. Dara Lind, who was one of my co-hosts for most of those episodes, you know, she was a real immigration specialist. You know, and I think also clear that, like, you know, she and the people in the immigration advocacy community, broadly speaking, they would, like, concede that things were going kind of off the rails, right? And that, like, we should do something to fix the system. But what they really wanted was to make sure that, you know, like a decently large number of people would get these claims positively adjudicated. And we had a lot of expansion, actually, like of the eligible categories, right? The whole deal.
I don't want to do a bunch of minoring here. So, like, what we're talking about here is how to set up like a, like, I agree with you that a lot of people who care about immigration, including myself, are like sort of like, all right, more people come in, great. Like that seems good to me because I have broader views about whether or not it's good for immigration to come in or not. But like on the merits itself, like
right.
I think that like, and what I hear you getting at is that like, okay, maybe we can fix this problem with a few billion a year and then people don't think there's a loophole anymore and then there are fewer people trying to come in through asylum. But like, why do we even have asylum to begin with? And like, I think asylum on the merits is a good thing that many Americans actually do think should exist.
Well, here's the question, right? I mean, because again, when it was small, if it's small again, you know, things that are small by definition are like not that big of a deal, right? And so if you get a future where like 400 people are making asylum claims per year and six of them are getting in, I'm not going to...
400's a little bit
insane.
But I mean, like, I just mean...
But I'm just saying, like, the process that I started having during this time, right, is on the one hand, like, I was writing various articles that are like, you know, these, like, anti-immigration people are being kind of crazy. They are wildly exaggerating the downsides of immigration, and they are wildly underestimating the upsides of immigration. And, you know, eventually I get the idea of writing a book that is going to pull together a bunch of different things that I'm interested in, housing and transportation, but also immigration, right? And it's called 1 Billion Americans, and it was like
fantastic
an effort
book.
To... You know,
The original abundance.
We frame a lot of these ideas in sort of like patriotic national greatness terms. And what happens when you write a book, you know, is you need to, you know, the whole book is like mostly just stuff I already thought, but you need to put your ideas together like in a more systematic, more holistic
way. You actually
way.
Don't have to. You can just publish a bad book.
Well, fair enough. You know, and like decide what you actually think, mm-hmm. right? And the more I dug into, like, no, morons, like, immigration is good. Immigration is good for America. The more I found myself pivoting on the other side of it to, like, immigration policy should be designed to maximize the national interest. And the sort of proceduralism and reactiveness of asylum does not fit into that very well.
I think this is a bit weird. I mean, do you think this is true for all criminal justice? Do you think that the criminal justice system should not have procedural rights?
It's not that the criminal justice system shouldn't have procedural rights.
Yeah.
But like the criminal, the main reason, you know, as I always say, right, like the criminals get rights to protect the innocent.
And because people have rights even if they've committed crimes.
Well, yes. And, but like when you're even convicted, you're, you know, punished in ways that you wouldn't punish an innocent person.
Sure, yeah.
So just, you know, trying to do first principles and like think about not, you know, me being less reactive as a writer, right? Mm-hmm. Like instead of me saying, well, you know, if we look at the Hmong refugees in Minneapolis, you get such and such outcome and like it's actually broadly good. If you were like, how are we going to maximize economic growth in the Twin Cities over the next 50 years? It's like,
but this is such a narrow view of national interest.
Yeah.
Like national, well, no, but I'm saying like, if you ask individual people, I mean, and the thing is, this is why I think that the immigration and like public opinion debate has gotten like way too black and white here.
This is why I'm trying to stay away from public opinion.
But my point is when you think about national interest, it's also like what people believe to be a good outcome for their country. It's not just like we just look at GDP, which if we did, maybe we wouldn't have an asylum seeker system per se, but we'd have like a lot more immigrants and many of the same people would probably come in through a different system. But it's also like, hey, I want to live in a country that actually reflects my values. And I want to be clear, this is not just like Jerusalem doing her like lib bullshit, which is like, I'm also doing that. But like when you look at systematic efforts to try to figure out when and why people support different kinds of groups coming in asylum, you largely see that there's like actually like a clear pattern of deservingness. And like people will probably be surprised by this. But when you look at Afghan translators, right, you mm-hmm. had like an 84% support for resettling Afghan asylum seekers because people thought there's like a deservingness aspect. They'd help the United States. This isn't new. Ukrainian refugees, 78% of Americans approved admitting up to 100,000 mm-hmm. Ukrainian refugees. It's not 400, Matt. That's like 100,000
yeah.
people. This is old, even older when we had a much more anti-immigration country. 66% of Americans approved admitting ethnic Albanian refugees from Kosovo. And again, this is not just the United States. Even in far more anti-immigration countries, there's like a great study by Bansack, Heinmuller, and Hongartner, which I'm probably saying those all wrong. They look at 15 European countries, and they again see this over and over again, that like people are willing to be in favor of this. And so when I think about shifting the asylum system, like the problem to me is that we've conceived of it as there are all of these people in the world, like the masses of the world mm-hmm. are coming to your doorstep and they're in need. And it's like a charity, like you have to let them in and you have to let them in no matter what it does. And like from that aspect, I totally agree with you. Like I think like that entire framing is wrong. And I think harmed by the fact that we're often not making clear, discrete cases for specific groups of people that are either in the national interest, like Afghan translators, where it's like clearly like we want people like this to be able to help the American military or the American government when there are foreign entanglements that we're getting involved in for bad reasons. We still want people translating for us or for other reasons, like, you know, there's not like a huge reason to care about Albanian refugees other than the fact that we thought that like it was you know, it was bad.
Yeah,
what
so,
was happening
okay,
to
so
them?
I don't want to like overly interrogate the specifics of the polling on this kind of stuff. But I want to, I guess, like draw a distinction, right? When we were talking about doing this episode, like one framing I toyed with was that, like, humanitarian immigration is, like, gotta go, right? Because I've been reading, I was actually surprised when The Argument published an Alexander Kustov piece, because I think his views...
I publish a lot of people.
On immigration. No, I know. He's got a book about the politics of immigration, where, like, he is, like, very exclusively tethered to, you know, self-interest in, like, a very narrow kind of conception. I wanted to pivot my claim to, like, the asylum concept, mm-hmm. right? Because, again, the nature of the asylum concept is that it is legal and procedural and it is rights-based. I think the Afghan translator's situation, right, is a thing where the case one would make for it, I mean, not just public, to anybody, right, like, common sense, is that there is a obligation incurred by the United States of America mm-hmm. as a polity when other people work with us in a military effort. And so we should help those people out, right? It's a way of, you know, paying faith forward. If the United States had never invaded Afghanistan, or forgetting the United States, you just imagine, like, some other country, right? Like, there's a war between, you know, Kazakhstan and Tajikistan or something. And there's a bunch of Tajik translators who are working with the Kazakh army. And then the Kazakhs leave. And then the Tajik translators are getting in trouble back in Tajikistan. The case for the United States to take those people in is much weaker than the case for the Afghan translators, because they were working with our military, right? So this is a kind of, like, we can have immigration for lots of different kinds of reasons, but it's still, like, purposeful, intentional, selected, right?
But I think this actually presumes that the existing asylum system isn't actually good at determining when asylum cases are or are not legitimate. So you look at the 2024 data about asylum grant rates, and you have 11% for Dominican Republic nationals, 16.6% for Mexicans, 19.3% for Colombians, 19.7% for Ecuadorians. And then on the other end, for Afghans, Syrians, Cameroonians, Eritreans, and Venezuelans, it's like 75%+. And, like, that tracks my, like, basic understanding of which of these countries has a lot of people who are going to be fitting under the specific narrow definition of political asylum. And so, like, our existing system is actually quite good. And I think that you're underestimating, like, how difficult it would be for the government to select those people rather than ask them to petition themselves to us.
Like, see, but that, I don't read those numbers the same way that you do.
What do you mean?
Right? Well, because, like, well, go back, like, the Dominican and Mexican numbers.
Yeah, it's like 11% for Dominican Republic.
Right. So, like, this is what I, like, the Dominican Republic, country with problems. I'm sure people who want to move there from here have good reasons for it. But the Dominican Republic is, like, a democracy.
I mean, I don't know what's going on there, but, I mean, like, I think we'd have to, like, know the facts a bit more to, like, make claims that they don't actually fit under political asylum.
But, this is what I'm saying, though. Like, they are clearly fitting under political asylum.
Yeah.
In the existing legal structure of, like, what political asylum looks like. And I think it does not look like a reasonable system. That is, you know, that some fraction of people from Latin American, middle-income, imperfect Latin American democracies are successfully making asylum petitions is itself, like, that is the broken system. That is not selective immigration in the national interest.
I guess this is, like, my thing is, like, I understand that you, Matt Iglesias, believe this,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying, like, I don't think this is actually the viewpoint of Americans.
I mean, I don't know what is, I mean.
Like, you know what I mean? I'm just saying, like, you're just.
I'm trying to, like, not have a discussion just about politics, because I think it's clear if you look at the politics of the United States and every other country in, like, basically every election for the past generation, that, like, the real public support for immigration is lower than whatever is in these polls and these academic studies. Like, there's relentless growth of far right political parties, blah, 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 blah. But, like, I'm trying to, like, stick to the merits of this, right? The case for the Afghan translators is that I don't need to know anything about, like, the specific details. Like, we all remember that that war happened, and we all remember that American forces departed, and we all know that the Taliban is bad. So for any given asylum applicant, there's like a factual question, like, was this person in fact a translator who cooperated with the American military?
Mm-hmm.
But the, like, what is the normative case is like completely transparent, right?
Well, then
similarly, if you wanted to say, okay, we want to say, like, categorically, you know, if you are like, you know, a defector from the People's Republic of China, right, that, like, we want you in, right? And you would have to, like, write out some specifications of, like, what does that mean? Like, how are we going to make sure you're not a double agent or a spy or something like that? But like, that would be a policy, right? The Dominican Republic is like you could just go there on vacation. We have a free trade agreement with the Dominican mm-hmm. Republic. They're not like a formal treaty ally, but like, this is a friendly country. It is not a state that the United States of America regards as like a despotic adversary where we are trying to like cultivate a Dominican opposition.
But, I mean, my thing is just, I think that, like, to be clear, I think that the argument that you are laying out now is like very... we can call it ending asylum,
uh-huh.
but many people call this reforming the asylum system.
Yeah, but that would be a boring podcast.
Okay.
No, but this is...
But, like, this is... Okay.
This is why I consider it ending rather than reforming,
okay.
right? Is that with most immigration, right, there is a centrally directed, there is, like, a top-down quantitative limit on like what is happening, right? It is not a proceduralist rights-based claim the way that asylum is, right? Like, the way that asylum works, anybody who is physically present in the United States and is being faced with deportation can say, no, I deserve asylum. And
yes, there's like a set of reason that matters. The only reason that matters at all is because the system is incapable of keeping up with those claims. Like, if someone was like, oh, yeah, give me asylum right now, and then it took, you know, we put you in detention for 3 months, and then we're like, no, this is completely fake, and then we deported you, and because now you've been deported rather than leaving on your own, it's more difficult for you to come back to the United States. Like, this would just end the problem we're talking about.
But then,
the question that becomes to me, like, what is the purpose of, because I understand what you're saying. I'm saying, like, many of the problems that you're outlining here to me just, like, seem, like, very clearly, like, problems with the implementation of how the system is working right now. And I think this is not just the thing that we've already talked about with, like, you know, fixing all the judges or whatever, which I know you agree with, but it's also just like, if you expanded the legal pathways in our national interest, like, you made it possible for businesses to mm-hmm. hire workers that they needed when, you know, labor markets were incredibly tight, like they were during mm-hmm. the Biden years, etc., many of these people would just not be coming through this pathway. They would just take the legal pathways that were available to them. Like, that's the literal thing that you would expect to happen, because that's what happened before people were using the asylum system. They were using the other sorts of legal pathways that were available, and then they transferred over to asylum when that was no longer available.
I mean, one would hope, right? I mean, part of my interpretation of the increase in asylum claims starting in the late aughts is that I think, you know, there was this big push for border security mm-hmm. starting in the later years of the Bush administration. Well, sure, a different one. I think we essentially succeeded in making it harder to, like, sneak across the border to work illegally. And then we had the Great Recession, so there was a decline in demand. And we continued investing in, like, the border security rollout during a period of years when there was very little demand to immigrate. And it, like, worked. And as is often the case with these things, it sort of backfired because the fundamental dynamic of, like, people want to move to the United States to work here when the unemployment rate is low and businesses like to hire people,
mm-hmm.
like, remained in place, right? So it's like the water starts trying to flow around the dam, and what they found was this asylum thing. I definitely favor, right, like, trying to create both, like, more generous, like, visa programs for skilled workers, other things like that, but also more, I guess we're calling it rotational labor rather than guest workers. But, like, you know, particularly, like, during a labor market boom, there should be a system by which, like, companies can recruit temporary workers to come live here and do jobs. And hopefully, if that is in place and that is working well, it reduces people's inclination to like want to try to find back doors and loopholes in the system, right?
Yeah.
Like I think we're both agreeing.
Yeah.
And I think the Biden administration tried a kind of like chewing gum and masking tape version of this with a lot of like parole programs and like quasi-legal immigration to try to like tamp down on the chaos element. And it sort of worked and sort of didn't. And if we had like a real Congress that did things, we could put together a better version of those kind of systems. All the more, that's like leaving me with not really seeing a big role.
Well, because there's like a bunch of things that are unknowns that you don't want to just leave to Congress to have to legislate on a dime about in order to make sure that you can actually meet your national interests needs in the moment. Like the Trump administration right now is destroying for all of like as many ways as possible for there to be like legal pathways that the president can quickly spit up. Like the parole programs, which you praised in a slow, boring article like many years ago as having actually reduced irregular migration when we had them, the CHNV program that the Biden administration stood up to actually process people and make sure they were eligible in these specific four countries to come to the United States. Like that program has not only been like canceled by the Trump administration, that's been rubber stamped by a Supreme Court at this point, which means like the process that you're talking about where you could just have the president go like, okay, well, like now we know we want to help this specific country because of this national interest, like that has been derailed. And now what we're left with is the asylum system and Congress. And so like in Matt's world, there's like a crisis happening somewhere and your entire faith is on the fact that Congress will pass something in time in order to do our national interest well. And to be clear, when Congress fails to do this at some point, the chaos that results is what actually creates the anti-immigration politics.
Well, that's not, yes, clearly like Congress sucks, everything sucks. You know, the next president is going to have to deal with a chaotic and difficult situation under whatever the circumstances are. We can't really know what they're saying. What I'm saying is that like, if we got to open up the box, right, and like have Congress change immigration laws, right, I would be there in the committee, wherever it is, I would be saying, like, we need, like, more visas for skilled workers. We need to, like, completely uncap certain categories of programs. We need to create some, like, legal guest worker programs, things like that. We need to preserve some level of presidential discretion around different kinds of things. But if restrictionists are coming to me and they're like, but, like, we gotta scrap these asylum courts, you know, we got to tell people, you know, if you're transiting anywhere, it's like, that's where I'm like, yeah, you know, like that makes sense. Like, especially in the context of we're making these reforms to change, to like create more selective, more organized pathways. Like, I just don't see a strong argument for the proposition that we should be letting kind of random immigration judges look at cases that they feel sympathetic about and saying like, yeah, you know, 16% of Mexicans are getting their claims approved. Because again, like Mexico, it's one of these countries where like, obviously there are lots of profound problems in Mexico. You know, there's like a very serious interplay between organized crime and state governments in Mexico. It's also just much poorer than the United States. Like, I get why people want to come here. And if I was empowered, right, if a specific Mexican individual was sitting in front of me and I was empowered to give that person the right to live and work in the United States, I would feel like incredibly tempted to just give it to them, right? Because I'm a humane person. Like, I care about the world. I don't want to send someone back to be deported to deal with cartel shit and all kinds of other terrible stuff. But like, again, Mexico is a democracy. Mexico is a friendly country. We have a free trade agreement with Mexico. We have like formal diplomatic process with Mexico. I don't think it makes sense to say that like there are political refugees from Mexico or from the Dominican Republic or other things like that. If we want to create as part of our foreign policy apparatus, like selective humanitarian immigration pathways, that makes sense, but it has to be integrated with like the whole rest of our foreign policy outlook.
Okay, so I just asked Claude like why Mexican asylum cases are coming through.
Are we just going to have AI is going to resolve these questions?
Well, we don't have time to do the debate. I didn't look into this. I'm just going to pop in, say,
is asylum good?
Claude's going to say yes.
Okay, you let Claude's me know what Claude says about Mexico.
No, but So apparently it's a few cases. One, it's journalists covering cartels or corruption. Uh-huh. So they're journalists who can document specific published stories about cartels or government corruption and specific threats tied to those stories, the Mexican government's inability or unwillingness to protect them, and often the murder of colleagues or family members. Those are the ones we're getting grants. The second are LGBTQ asylum seekers. So it is folks who have particularly from states with actual patterns of violence against these people. So it's not just like anywhere in Mexico, because obviously some places it's not as a problem. And third, it's family members of cartel targets, which is very, very conditional on being able to prove this. And to be clear, like 84% of these cases of Mexican asylum claims are not succeeding. I just think it's very weird to look at that and go like, these judges are like real like soft-hearted libs who like can't get over the fact this person's begging not to be sent back. Like, and again, like, I don't want to make this, I don't agree it's not about public opinion here, but when we're conceiving of what is in the national interest, like, it is in the national interest to have a country with, like, reasonable values. I think that people don't want their countries to, like, be completely without any level of care for issues that Americans care about, like, freedom of speech and journalists being able to cover, like, a literal cartel that's causing spillover problems in multiple American states.
So again,
like,
I mean,
like, that's a category where I think it's actually really just, like, I think that if the American president got up and was like, hey, it's really important that people cover this horrible shit that cartels are doing. It's creating problems in Arizona. It's creating problems in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. It's creating problems in Texas. We think these are bad people. Look at how they're murdering the families of journalists. The Mexican government, we're leaning on them to protect these journalists, but they can't do it or they won't do it for whatever reason. And if they come to this country, we think we should give them asylum claims. I agree that someone should do that rather than letting it just happen without any kind of explanation to the public. But I don't think that actually means getting rid of the system. We're expecting Congress to, like, legislate around these very specific categories.
Okay, but I feel like this is maybe more convergent than you're
seeing. Well, I think it's like, what do you think should happen? Maybe this would be helpful. Like, what should happen? Like, let's say in your world, there's no asylum. Congress has not made some specific carve out for journalists in Mexico. And a journalist from Mexico who's done great work or whatever, comes to the United States and says, help me, they're about to murder me. Like, you think what should happen? I don't think that people think that that person should just be sent back to be murdered.
I agree. But this is my point, though. Like, these are sympathetic individual cases, right? And in the case of Mexicans, I think you have the strongest claim because the United States is obviously adjacent to Mexico, right? And like, you know, we have a lot. I mean, no country enjoys it when like a bunch of refugees like cross the border because there's a civil war in the adjacent country. But in almost every case, the view is that you can't like just like put the guards at the border and be like, no, you have to come, right? That's like immediate crisis, something. You know, I mean, I was very struck again. This was during...
But that's asylum, Matt. What you just said is asylum.
To an extent. You know, I've been to San Antonio and seen people who had come from Congo into South America, overland, through Mexico to the southern border, apprehended there. CBP has limited language capacities. And so they bus those people to San Antonio, which is the big city that's closest to the border, where they have more translators. You got the Congolese translators there. And what the people are asking to do is be sent to Maine, where there's a Congolese community, you know, and they have relatives, things like that. Some of those people, I think, have invalid claims. Some of them have claims that, like, probably there's a lot of problems in Congo. You know what I mean? Like, people who are saying they're being persecuted, stuff like that. Like, that's not BS, right? But it's also not, like, imminent emergency, right? When you're, like, going from continent to continent, across oceans, across multiple countries, right? It's different from the kind of classic, you know, refugees at the border, right? Again, to me, this is just an example of a system where what was written down in policy in the years following World War II was meant for a set of circumstances that has like stopped applying in the modern world. And it requires changes that are tantamount to, I mean, look, if for some reason it goes down better with like libs to call this reforms to asylum, like I'm all for that. But like, In your Mexican case, you know, the United States of America, whether through, you know, discretion granted to the executive branch or explicit congressional action, has policy toward Mexico, right? Like a country that is nearby. The cartel activity in Mexico is a significant public policy issue in both the United States and Mexico. Different administrations on both sides of the border have had different approaches to that. Saying as part of Mexico cartel policy, we want to establish a process whereby people whose lives are at risk from the cartels can get refuge in the United States, like that could make some sense. And you would have to think about what are the rules of that program? What's its exact purpose? Like, are we trying to get people to cooperate with us in legal cases? Are we trying to make the Mexican government like us more? Like, what are we trying to do here, right? Versus a system where it's just how objectively threatened you are is the criteria. Because I just don't think that that fundamentally makes sense. If you talk about one person, like I'm a humane person, like I get it, right?
Yeah.
But when you start getting to, oh, the system's overwhelmed, oh, we need more judges, blah, 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 like, yes, to an extent, but like also we need a policy. We need to say, like, how many people are we taking in? Why are we taking them in? What are the categories of eligibility? Did you read the story that the BBC did recently about like Nigerians going to the UK and being coached into how to like pretend that they're gay?
Okay, I think that the places of overlap between our positions are largely that we think it's really important for a case to be specifically made about the people that we're letting in, and that the system not just brought like the mass majority of immigrants should not be coming in some sort of system where like they've never been justified on the grounds they're coming into the United States. I think that is like completely reasonable. I think we live in a democracy. There should be like clearly some sort of like public reasoning about what we're doing, because it's an obligation we have to citizens and residents of this country to be clear on what's going on and why and what the process actually looks like and how decisions are being made. That's just like a fundamental right or a fundamental way that liberal democracy is supposed to work. But I think there are a few things I want to draw out here, because I think that what's different about our positions is a few things. One, I think discretion with really high impact cases is actually really important. I mean, like most of my work is about like places, and my journalism is about like places that the government should have like way less discretion, because like, what the fuck are you doing? Like every single house does not need to be go through like a historical design review process in order to decide whether or not you should be allowed to build it or not. If it's a triplex or a quadplex, like who gives a shit? Like just like fucking let's keep going, because there's no point in like the error rate, right? If you err on the side of building, if you accidentally build a house that was slightly outside the design review, like the costs there are not that great relative to the cost of like running a system with high discretion. But that's different with immigration, Matt. Like with immigration, the stakes are incredibly, incredibly high, and the cost of running the system is actually not that high. So now we have a situation where instead of like the housing situation or other kinds of areas where we want to reduce discretion, we have a situation where like the stakes for getting it wrong are that people die in ways that no one would want to see happen, or American interests are undermined. And like, let's be clear here. It's not just like, oh, it's boohoo, it's really sad that someone gets murdered somewhere else. It's like, if America deports someone to be murdered by a horrible regime, that's actually a problem for our national interests. Like, that's not like a good outcome for like, you know, our ability to do diplomatic relations, to whatever. Like, there's lots of things that create issues if that's a news story that goes viral. And again, those things actually do make Americans, I think, set Americans apart in really not wanting to see their country do that. But I think that, like, implicit to a lot of what you're saying, and I think I hear this explicitly from other people, is there's this expectation that there's going to be just like this, like, if you allow this to happen, like, okay, it's $1 billion now to make the system work. It's $2 billion. But like soon, every single one in the world is going to come to our doorstep. And like, we're not going to be able to process that, because that will be the entire GDP of America. It'll be able to manage. And like, I think this is like fundamentally founded on like an incorrect premise about how many people actually want to migrate. I do not think.
So how many people want to migrate?
I mean, you can look at like the, I think that like, let's take like the really hard case, like for instance, Venezuela, right? Where you have like 10,000,000% inflation. It's a really bad situation, whatever. I think it's like 70%+ of the country don't even leave. This happens also, 70%+ of people don't leave either also in like Sudan or in Syria when this happens. And I think less than 5% leave the immediate region, even in the worst situation imaginable, like a Syria-level state breakdown where, like, actively people are going to be murdered if they stay. 70-plus percent stay. And then of the people who leave, like single-digit percentages leave the immediate area. So, like, obviously,
okay,
there's a
like
lot of people.
Plenty of Syrians, enough Syrians left the immediate area to, like, destabilize all of European
but
politics for multiple years.
It's a question of where you want to put the, like, problem. Like, is, like, to me, and this is my fundamental view of, like, all of the majority of, like, the immigration backlash, is it is fundamentally founded in chaos, not in specific numbers. And, like, you can see this because in Australia, which is, like, every, you know, mm-hmm. immigration yeah. mod's favorite country.
Love Australia. I've never been, but I hear good things.
Australia's system is, like, from American perspective, like, quite draconian. They can do this for a couple reasons. One is that they're, like, obviously an island, but, like, secondly, that, like, most of the people who are trying to come to Australia are trying to come on boats from usually, like, Indonesia, and Indonesia has mostly been willing to take those people back if Australians just, like, return them on mm-hmm. boats back. Notably, when Indonesia decides not to do this, it creates, like, a massive political backlash within Australia. So, like, even in Australia right now, you see far-right populist backlash happening in a country where, like, we're talking about, like, extremely small numbers of irregular migration causing chaos.
Right.
And so to me, it's like, unless you can generate a system, which no one can, in which you can, like, eliminate all ability for anyone to come at any point without expectation, then you need to have a system that can process unexpected numbers of people coming in,
but, like,
and have judges that can adjudicate, like, hey, should you come in or should you not? Like, that's the whole point of having a discretionary system.
But this is why, like, we're talking about this at all now, because, you know, when Biden was president, right, there was all this, like, hemming and hawing, and, like, he said, like, we needed new legislation and blah, blah, blah. I think you wrote a piece about how, like, deterrence won't work, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Like, Trump has become president, and whatever problems are happening in the United States of America now, and they are many, we are not grappling with large quantities of people making asylum claims.
Okay, sorry. I agree. If you make the United States of America so unappealing for people to come to, there will be a small break in people attempting to come here until they figure out other pathways of entry. And you know how I know this? Because in Trump 1, they literally started separating families from one another.
Yeah.
And you saw increases of families coming to the border under Donald Trump. Why? Because the American economy bounced back in 2019 and the labor market pulled a bunch of people in.
To an extent, but
no, not to an extent. It caught, like, despite all of the draconian measures we remember from Trump 1, mm-hmm. despite all of those things happening, the highest number of irregular arrivals at the Southwest border of all measurable time happened in 2019
yes,
under Donald Trump.
But right now,
yes.
the unemployment rate is very low.
Well, the hiring rate isn't.
And we're seeing, like, well, but I mean, I think we can argue which direction this is going, but, like, there's, like, negative migration, basically.
So, to be clear, I agree that because, like, what we see, and I read this piece, which Matt called out, which is about deterrence not working. When we say deterrence doesn't work, we're not saying, like, there's no way to pause the number of people coming in, but what we also observe from, like, places, for instance, like the Mediterranean, where
yeah.
in Europe, you know, way more draconian than what Trump's doing. They're, like, literally trying to capsize people's boats as they're coming
right.
over. People figure out other pathways and they try to figure out where the system is stabilized in order to figure out what next to do. Like, the pulls and pushes are still going to exist even under these regimes. And notably, I mean, I'm just putting this out here, and, you know, job openings are, like, half what they were in 2022, and the hiring rate is 3.1, whereas the hiring rate in March 2022 was, like, 7.4%.
Sure, so like, but like, yes. listen.
I just want to point those.
I am not, like, an anti-immigration maximalist.
I agree.
I want to get more immigration to the United States, but I mean, I think, like, the baseline is important to understand, right? Because we are now not having the Biden debate. We're not having the Trump 1 debate. We're not having the Obama debate. We're having a debate about, you know, say there's a
Would
new...
Would you recommend that a Democratic president have, like, 33% approval rating?
Absolutely not. I'm saying, like, you know, somebody new is taking over.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, or maybe it's not even somebody new, right? Like, Donald Trump is just phoning me up. He's like, Matt, like, mm-hmm. what should I do? I gotta improve my numbers. You know, and I would say, like, just, like, chill on the interior enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just let it slide a little bit. You know, like, who cares, right? And then I would say to him, like, your proposed H-1B reforms, like some of those ideas make sense, but like some of them are counterproductive. And if you can make H-1B better, you ought to expand the program, right?
But like the presumption here... I'm not even talking about, like, yes, you should tell Trump good policy ideas if he calls you up in that case. I'm not objecting to you doing that. But what I'm saying is that the politics of immigration are such that it actually does not serve anti-immigration forces to fix these procedural problems. Anytime there's a procedural issue,
I agree.
Like, sparks...
But this is why I'm trying to come up with like good advice. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm just like, how do you improve from this baseline where like people have been quite chilled from coming to the United States? Something Trump has done that I think is good and that Joe Biden should have done is that he has expanded H-1A agricultural worker visas, and he has also weakened the Department of Labor regulation of those people. Like the Biden administration, because it was so screwy, like the only restrictionist things it did were like labor regulations, right? They like made it harder to get no pair, stuff like that. And you should like drop all that stuff, like take all the well-organized channels and try to broaden them, right? Because like chaos is bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The thing about asylum, right? Like I don't want to make this sound excessively narrow, but like I really am harping on the proceduralism of it, because I think that you are inviting chaos, right? The difference between saying we are going to allow 700 LGBT Mexicans from the following three states to immigrate because somebody told us that this is a bad situation and people feel sympathetic, blah, blah, blah. Fine. And like, which three states, which are the right number? I don't know. You can negotiate it. But like, if there's a number and there's a region and it is set out in advance, that is fine. People can then apply. You can do the thing. You can have it. If you say, if you show up illegally and then argue ex post, no, I should have protection, and like you and your lawyer are allowed
to become
makeup
reasons.
Okay, to be
clear, though, it's not illegal to request asylum.
Okay, but
you're right. If they come, but like, I don't want to harp on
this. But they are coming illegally. No, but I mean, this is relevant
also, like,
to the
a lot of asylum seekers come here on legal visas and then request asylum. I just want to put
sure,
that out there.
There's that too.
But
this is why I tried to ask you about this before, but like the story about the UK and the sort of like Nigerian gay status fraud question, right? Where it's like the incentive.
There will always be an incentive to figure out a way to get into a country where you can like, without asylum, to like 20x your life's potential outcome.
Right. This is why I don't understand why we're disagreeing.
Exist.
Yes. There's this very
but
strong.
But I'm saying without asylum or with asylum, it will exist.
Yeah, but it's important, I think, to try to create immigration pathways that do not become invitations for rule breaking.
Anything you could possibly imagine. The O-1 visa is gamed. The H-1B visa is gamed. Like, there's not the system that you're talking about where you have like a very specific set of metrics and then someone has
but
to meet
people
them.
Have to apply from abroad, right? You're avoiding the chaos. Like, I think that you are big like chaos theorist in terms of immigration, right? It's about the chaos. It's about the disorder. It's not about the numbers. But then I think you shying away from the implications of that, right?
No, I'm not.
Which like go back to the Australian case that you talked about, right? You talked about how draconian like the Australian system is on asylum seekers. Australia also has like a significantly higher foreign-born population share than the United States, right? Like Australia is a big pro-immigration success story on a sustainable basis. But they put into effect like Jerusalemism. Right. Like it is fanatical about maintaining order. And you are correct that even very quantitatively small breakdowns in the orderliness of the Australian system create big shockwaves to the politics. And I think you had something similar in Canada, which is not literally an island, but has some of the same kind of geographic separation. And where for a long time, Canada had a very, very high foreign-born population share without a lot of political dissent around it. And the Trudeau government started flipping some switches and pulling some levers and changing things up. And the situation got more chaotic in Canada. And there was backlash to that. And so I think like you are correct to put to underscore the relative importance of orderliness versus like the sheer numbers that are involved. But that you're then shying away from what it takes to maintain orderliness. And I think that the functioning of a kind of ex post asylum system is an invitation to chaos.
I think restraining myself from interrupting you when you said that Australia was Jerusalemism, I think I deserve some sort of kudos for that, because that was
okay.
There was a beyond the pale, Matthew. So I think two things. I think the first thing I want to say is that like this question of gaming the system, I think is really important, because I think you and I both agree that many Americans really don't enjoy the idea that people are not coming here in order to even. Existing immigrants, right? They get very upset at the idea that there are people who are going mm-hmm. to jump the line, who don't get to follow, who don't have to quote-unquote follow the rules. Yeah. I think a lot of people often have mistaken understandings of how easy it is to follow the rules to come in, but putting that aside, they really don't like that idea. Mm-hmm. So then the question becomes, what is the way to reduce people from actually gaming the system? And I think a series of extremely specific and narrow, programs is actually incentivizing this gaming the system rather than de-incentivizing it. Like, yes, this Nigerian situation that you mentioned earlier about how people are being coached on how to, say that they're gay and at risk of LGBTQ violence. This is true in many other cases. There are people who are Ethiopians who are being coached to sound like they're from Eritrea. The entire purpose of having the asylum system is that you actually have like subject matter experts on the ground who are like, I know things about Ethiopia and Eritrea, and I ask you questions about Eritrea, and like you say you've been coached, but like I am someone maybe with like you have gotten coached by like a random person you paid $1,000 to for like a week, and I am someone who's an American like consulate official or whatever it is, or asylum officer, who like is literally trained and has been to your country, who's been to this country you're faking being from or whatever for ages. And so like, do you, for instance, faking that you are LGBTQ, do you have evidence? They don't just say like, hey, yeah, I'm gay. You have to be like, show us any kind of evidence that you've ever been gay. Have you told anyone that you're gay? Have you been persecuted in any way? Like, I think that the whole point of like these kinds of judicial systems is to be able to say like, okay, let's say Matt's perfect world, there is some allotment from, like, as you mentioned, these Mexican LGBTQ persecuted individuals. There still is a discretionary system that people will try to game. Like, that doesn't go away.
Okay, but the difference here, right, is between, you know, you're saying people game O2, you know, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But like, there's a difference between any kind of thing, which is like apply for a visa at your consulate, mm-hmm, and a thing that's you are here already in the country and you are asking.
But that's Australia. Most of Australians' foreign-born population are visas. Not, I don't know if it's most, but very many of these are right. People who are on visas who then are applying, going like, can I have asylum now? Like, or like, can I stay here? Or can I whatever? Like, that's what we're talking about.
Sure. But I'm saying in the invitation to chaos, right, that we were seeing in the United States under Obama, that I think they're seeing now in the UK, right, it's from the fact that, like, you can come in an irregular manner and then make the asylum claim. In Australia, they categorically forbid that.
And there's still irregular migration to Australia.
There is some, but
there
is much
less. Because we live in an irregular world,
Matt. There is some and there is much less. But again, like...
But my point is this. Like, what are we trying to solve for?
This is why I say that Australia is Jerusalemism. Because, like, what are we trying to solve for? Like, I want to have a world in which we have a good amount.
1 billion Americans.
Well, broadly in the world, right? Like, international labor mobility has a lot of benefits. Many, many countries are very poorly governed. Lots of people are suffering from, illiberal, LGBT persecution, for example, like, it's bad, right? Like, I don't know. It's not good. And the United States benefits from a growing labor force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think it's a little bit perverse that I feel like, not you, not accusing you, but I think that the kind of like lib NGO Borg in the United States of America views the pre-Trump American system as better than the Australian system because they regard the American system as less inhumane. But like, they're letting in more immigrants in Australia.
Well, not more.
No, well, relative to the population.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like 7 people in Australia. But like, I think if you take seriously the view that it's not really the numbers that matter, it's the chaos and the orderliness, like that points to.
But I think I'm actually surprised mm-hmm. by this view of yours. I'm not surprised that you want to mod out on immigration, but I think I'm surprised this at like a principled level that you have, because exactly what you said about like free movement of people and of understanding like there's a lot of random cases that are still very positive, some that are in the national interest of the United States to exist, that are very, very difficult to categorize. And I agree, we want as many applications happening in, not at the Southwest. Like, I don't think anyone thinks it's good that these things happen at the Southwest border. That's why, you know.
I feel like these immigration lawyers do. I mean,
I don't think that they think it's, a lot of these NGOs were in favor of the processing centers being set up through Latin America, of the CHNV parole programs, which processed people in their home countries, of the creation of the CBP1 app, which made it possible for people to actually get an appointment so they could actually meet with an asylum officer rather than just flooding across the border randomly. I mean, all of these things were put in place by people who wanted a less chaotic system and who didn't think it was good that people were just showing up and asking for
sure.
it. And like, but I think the critical distinction between our positions here is that there are going to be some situations, unforeseen situations, that are like very, very bad and that are in our national interest to be able to respond to quickly. And we should develop systems like the asylum system where we can have legal ways of adjudicating whether someone fits into this. And it is not just completely subject to the like ability of Congress to get its shit together in the moment. And so like that is the distinction here. And I think also to say this, just like there, when we're talking about what's in America's national interest here, there is this like view that is, I think, percolating, that is not just, you know, the specific thing that we're talking about right now, but there's a view that's percolating on a lot of the centrist think tank Borg, which is this idea that you can sort of plan your way to the level of immigration success America has had. The American success with immigration has largely been founded on like open borders. It was Ellis Island open borders, unless you had literally like syphilis or something like that. It was open borders for Mexicans to go in and out. And like all of these studies that we have showing that the economics of the United States, the culture of the United States, the whatever, the innovation, the dynamism, the Nobel laureates, like whatever we're talking about, are founded on a system in which, of course, no one could select for that, which is something that you believe in many other contexts where like it's very, very difficult to like have central planning of these sorts of things. And like, but now with like perhaps the most important market that will ever exist ever, we're like, yeah, we can central plan that and it'll be fine. Like, I think that would genuinely harm the national interest.
But this is what I'm saying. Like, I take this through like turn the lens backwards. I think there are lots of people who unambiguously do not qualify for asylum in the United States.
Yes.
Who it would be good for them and it would be good for the United States if they moved here.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And that makes me less worried about denying like a good claim to some random person, because I think there are so many tragic non-immigration, you know, like blocked migration scenarios under the status quo, right? And like, that's really bad. And that we ought to be thinking really hard about how do we get a system that allows for more immigration to the United States in a sustainable way, which is like a little bit caring about the electoral politics, but it's also just a little bit caring about the fact that, you know, we saw this with the like the Greg Abbott and the busing stunts, that like that was a good political stunt that created political backlash. But the reason it created political backlash is that he created a substantive problem. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't just like, oh, people in Chicago are freaking out. Like, they were freaking out because there was a problem.
Because they couldn't handle it. Yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, there's a universe in which a large number of immigrants come to Chicago and it's fine for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, it literally happened with Ukrainians at the exact same time.
But there's also a universe in which a relatively small number of immigrants arrive in Chicago and it's a catastrophe.
Yes.
Right? So, like, there's a, you know, dynamic interplay between the substance and the public opinion.
Yes.
And I think that if you want to solve for, like, immigrant maxing over a long time horizon.
Yeah.
That requires being like really strict about anything that smacks of chaos and being tough-minded about these individual sympathetic cases and really trying to assure people and create a system that is based on, like, what is the maximum number of maximally advantageous immigration interactions.
We are agreeing about the fact that there need to be clear, like, 80% of these people, of Mexicans, are being sent back. Like, that the system that I am supporting is not like, man, we're just like letting anyone in. Like, even before the Biden years, the problem was the backlog, right? It wasn't that like the judges were just letting anybody in. Like, there's variety of like admittance rates per judges.
Well, it's the backlog, and it's the quantity, I think, of like countries being traversed. You know what I mean? Like, you're creating chains of chaos and problems globally.
I think that like the history of humanity has been that people are going to try to cross places to get to better opportunity, and that like mm-hmm. we're not going to like eliminate that when there's such massive differences in people's life outcomes depending on like a border that they are across. And so like we're not going to solve that. Like that's actually not a thing to be solved. That's a thing to like fix. But I think more broadly, the substantive problem that I still think you're not really addressing is that there are going to be many, many situations in the national interest that you cannot plan for. So I don't understand, like, it will not be, it's not like a small, and that will create chaos. Like, it's not a small problem if, like, we just don't have a system one day to, like, let in this important Chinese dissident who, whatever, and they get back and they get murdered by the Chinese government, or like, disappear. Like, that's, like, a big issue. And, like, I agree there are problems in both worlds, but, like, you're not even explaining how you would solve for that.
I mean, I just think we're, like, flipping really fast from, like, Chinese dissident to...
You're the one who said crossing multiple
to
borders.
Like, cartel journalist in Mexico or
LGBT in Nigeria. I already solved that.
listen.
I meant, like, an actual legitimate a case where you and I both agree there's a political asylum case.
Sure. So, I mean, look, I sort of think that if asylum goes away in the United States and, like, other Western countries... Mm-hmm. You know, for like a while, and people continue to want to move, and like things keep happening. But like this particular channel, like it goes away. It's like forgotten, you know, in the short-term mythos of like how do people do things? How does things operate? Like we will probably end up reinventing some version of this, right? In much the way that
we're debating.
No. Like I think we're trying to debate, like, what do we do? How do we get up off the floor of Trumpism? Because I think we saw this experiment with Biden of being like, the witch is dead, you know, like we're free again. And it was a fucking catastrophe.
Yeah.
Like right away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think part of what drove the catastrophe was precisely the kind of like progressive liberal moralism, right? Like the most outrageous form of immigration denial is like somebody who doesn't come and then they die because they're persecuted in their home country versus just like a skilled electrician who could be making more money in the United States and like also helping people, I don't know, get whatever the fuck electricians do. My sister-in-law trained as an electrician.
We're all going to be electricians one day.
Yes, so we're all, because we need the data centers, right? But like we need to focus on getting the electricians, you know, on like getting student visas operating in a reasonable way.
I actually think this is the distinction between our views is that like, I think that the ability to select in a like central planning type way for the people who are going to benefit the United States is much harder than like you are letting on. Like many of the people who we like hold up as, wow, like this CEO is a children of immigrants. Would their father have gotten in on the skilled immigrant visa? Maybe. I haven't looked at all of them, but some of them, it's not true. Some of them require this. Like, you know, there are many, many people who, like, we're talking about here who end up being the exact, like, one category person, this extraordinary individual who, like, none of the existing pathways that were designed to let in extraordinary individuals would have let in. And, like, me and you usually agree about this, about like the beauty of allowing these like kind of markets to form that would allow people to come into places where they are needed and wanted and they themselves would be benefited and you know, these positive sum interactions. But like, I think that if we're talking about how to get up off the floor of Trumpism, it is, yes, part of it is understanding that national interest is a core way of of is the only way of thinking about immigration, that it cannot be thought of as like a charity to other people. That's definitely true. But also that, like, I mean, I'm not interested in abandoning the very core precepts of like liberalism in order to short-term respond to an immigration crisis where even very liberal countries are facing the exact same political problems. The Denmarks, the Australias, like these places that like supposedly cracked down on immigration and like fixed their politics, like did not do so. So if this conversation is about what do we do after Trumpism to actually build up an immigration system, it's yes, we need to fix the asylum system so that people who are coming to this country are coming here under real pretenses and they're not like coming here under false ones. We need to make sure the courts are staffed up to be able to absorb those individuals. And we need to make sure we're expanding as many legal pathways as possible and not ones that are like hyper narrowly tailored like you're talking about, but are actually able to absorb the individuals who are going to make the country a better place. And I just
but
don't
think I'm not trying to say that we need to be hyper narrow with our selectivity. What I'm trying to say is that like Australia and Canada have sustained higher levels of legal immigration relative to their numbers.
And they're not as great as the United States.
And that it's not, well.
And no, I'm serious. Like literally what you're talking about are countries that have not been able to produce the benefits to their citizens the U.S. has been able to produce.
All right. I do love America. I'll let you have the last word. Should we do peer review?
Yeah. Yeah, we have fun paper.
Okay. What have you got?
Okay. So I am a middle child, so I love papers about birth orders. And this one is a really interesting one that kind of looks into the consequences of what they call germs in the family. So as we know, kids get sick, preschool age kids in particular, daycare kids get sick. I saw some other study that showed that, you know, if you have a kid in daycare, like one out of 2 days as a parent, you're sick.
Yeah.
So anyway, kids get sick a lot.
That's true.
And they spread disease to other family members. And they basically use Danish administrative data to document that before age one, younger siblings have 2 to 3 times higher hospitalization rates for respiratory conditions than older siblings. So like if you have an older sibling who's going to daycare, they're probably bringing home some illness and then you're going to the hospital a lot more, but your older sibling didn't have anyone in the home doing that when you were a kid. So they find like really lasting impacts on early life respiratory disease exposure on younger siblings' earnings, educational attainment, chronic respiratory health, mental health related outcomes. And this like speaks to this broader question of like, why is it that like younger siblings just like underperform?
Yeah, just to like set the stage, because I feel like, you know, as a older child.
Yeah.
And the husband of another older child. Yeah. And, you know, we're big on eldest children pride in my household. But like a lot of people don't know, but younger kids are, they're inferior objectively. they earn less. They have less education.
I think they go to jail more too.
Yeah. And this, as far as we can tell, like it compounds. It's like second kid's better than third. There's not that many fourth and fifth kids anymore, but it's like,
gets worse and worse.
And you know, and they study like both like family size and birth order effects, and like both are relevant.
And people are like, oh, maybe it's because parents don't have as much time for their kids as like, you know, you have all this time for your first kid and you're like really invested in them, but then the second kid you're like, all right, well, I literally my time is divided between two children, but also just like maybe you're like less enamored of your second kid or
no
kid,
I mean, I think especially if you're a parent, this is the most intuitive explanation. I mean, if I look at like friends that I have, and you know, you can see that like third kids speak a little bit later than like first kids, and it's pretty clearly because like if you only have one baby, it's like you got to take care of the baby, and it's like you talk to the baby a lot like for no real reason. It's just the baby's there, right? And they learn language. Parents with three kids, like they get really busy, and the third kid's just kind of being dragged along in a snuggly to the older kid's activities and stuff all day. And so it seems like this kind of like relative parental attention effect is like very intuitive to anyone who's like been in the shit with it. But like this paper is positing that there's this like actually more important like basic biological mechanism, which is that the third kid is being bombarded with germs all the time.
And it's not like small, it's like it's 2 to 3 times the rate of firstborns that they're sorry secondborns are hospitalized for acute respiratory conditions 2 to 3 times the rate of their firstborn.
But there's a low base rate of hospitalization.
Sure. My point is, like, if that's happening, then, like, you should imagine that the getting sick rate is also higher. All the people who are, most people don't go to the hospital for getting sick.
Subclinical respiratory infections are happening at a very high level.
At a very high level. And, like, you know, I think we now know post-COVID it's much better known that, like, there's, like, real long-term issues with having, like, viral infections that can affect, you know, your long-term health. And it's obviously much worse for infants. I don't know what the, like, practical advice is here. I feel like there's, like, a, maybe there's, like, a birth spacing question here, which I think is not good for the pronatalist movement here. If you don't want to have a kid in daycare when you have a, you know, your infant in the home. I hear there's another thing about, I actually should have looked this up beforehand, so our fact checker will tell us if we're wrong in the show notes, but having an infant that's born in winter is worse for life outcomes too, because I'm more likely to get sick at that time of year. But you only have one kid, so you don't have to worry about this.
Yeah, I mean, I do think these are sort of more internal questions for right of center, you know, because there's, like, there's a lot going on in right of center politics. That's both where you find more people who are talking about how, like, people should have more babies. It's also where you find people who are more, like, pro inequality. Right. And, like, saying, like, well, we should, like, be less concerned with the less fortunate and so on and so forth. And I do think that you see in, like, in this, in a lot of these findings, right, there's, like, a slight tension between those two ideas, that it's, like, when you have more kids, it's not that, like, you'd be worse off not existing or something, right? But it's, like, you are likely to get below average outcomes with, like, the marginal child in increasing family sizes. And so the question of, like, what do we as a society, like, do with people who are below average in educational attainment, earnings potential, et cetera, is, like, relevant to how you think about that. And from a progressive standpoint, like, the people who aren't having children are also the ones who are, like, sure, but this, like, 40th percentile person, like, deserves healthcare and housing and pensions and, like, all this good stuff. And so it's, like, in that world where all these below average people are also having great lives because of our egalitarian economic structure, then it seems like a no-brainer. It's, like, sure, like, have the fourth child, right? But in the, like, harsh, you know, like, Night Watchman state universe, that, like, seems like a dicier proposition to me. I don't know. It's, like, I both only, you know, I'm like, we're all part of the same hypocrisy here. I'm just on the other side of it. Yeah. So, like, it's fine. Like, I'm happy to, like, give welfare benefits to somebody else's seventh child, but it's
And I mean, it's not, like, small too. Like, they're finding that the earnings impact of, like the usual, the penalty for being the second kid on earnings gets cut in half, based on the respiratory, if you control for the infancy disease environment.
But also because almost everything we do in terms of, like, social benefits, right, is done on a per capita basis, right? So it's, like, you know, you take something that I'm not that excited about, like free college tuition, right? Like, that's a lot more money to a family with four kids than to a family with one kid, right? It's, like, you know, you're doing, all right, the politics is a little, I don't want to say it's upside down exactly, but like, it's interesting that we land in this alignment. This is also part of the 1 billion Americans message,
it all comes
right?
Back.
Is that, like, yeah, that, like, you know, I think that, you know, a well-designed immigration system has positive fiscal benefits. Mm-hmm. And I think that a, like, strongly pronatal political system probably costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But that, like, that's probably worth it to have, like, a society that, like, persists over time. But, like, the challenge is, it's not just that, like, it's stressful to, like, deal with a lot of kids, right? There's, like, real reasons sort of, like, driving people to smaller family sizes, including, you know, these, like, slightly hidden, but, like, also quite real, like, dealing with sick kids, like, when you also have jobs and things like that, this is a big problem.
All right. Well, from someone with zero kids and someone with one kid, we're not going to tell you how many kids to have. But if you liked this episode, you should subscribe. Next week, we have a very special one. Matt and I spent some time reading a very old book. I guess not that old, but it's The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan.
Yeah, she will tell you how many kids to have.
She will definitely
fewer. Tell
you how many children to have. It's actually a really great segue. So if you are interested in reading along, feel free. I'll see you next week.
Bye.